With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Farm Bureau secure grant funding for soil projects and water efficiency. Farm bureaus in Butte and Solano counties were awarded $10 million in grants through the California Department of Food and Agriculture to fund projects that support health and water efficiency. The two farm bureaus received $5 million each from the state's Healthy Soils Program and the State Water Efficiency Enhancement Program, also known as SWEEP. Grants for Butte County Farm Bureau support projects in Butte, Glenn, and Tehama counties. Grant monies for Solano County Farm Bureau support projects in Solano, Alameda, Contra Costa, Sacramento, and Yolo counties. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report. And now let's get into today's show headlines. In today's Ag News from AgNet West, is a multi-year farm bill extension possible? When you talk about Congress, where do you start as we move into a new week? As far as agriculture goes, the Ag Appropriations Bill has not been passed, which also means any talk on getting a new farm bill keeps getting pushed back. How far back may be the next question. September 30th was the deadline for the current farm bill expiring, and more officials are saying a one-year extension will be more likely needed. The next question is, will a one-year extension be long enough to get a new farm bill passed? Ethan Lane is Vice President of Governmental Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
I think it's just as likely that we could see this put off until the next Congress. And, you know, I remind people the 2012 Farm Bill didn't get signed until 2014. This is not unprecedented to go down a route like this. And again, this is a $1 trillion bill. Yes, 85% of it is nutrition spending, but this is a big, expensive bill that we're talking about at a time when all of the focus is on cutting government spending. You kind of have to wait for this fever to break before you debate a bill like this, or it will go down. And, you know, a lot of us talk about the fact that at some point, the last farm bill is going to be the last farm bill. And, you know, you always worry this is that farm bill that just doesn't have the political environment to get across the finish line. Because those are the dynamics, if it needs to go into the beginning of the next Congress, in my opinion, so be it. You know, get those programs to a point where the folks with Farm Safety Net program issues are handled and, you know, in a good spot. And then wait for the right opportunity. But trying to force this thing, and I think that the chairman and the chairwoman on both sides of the Hill know this, trying to force this thing, you know, may break the mechanism. That's not something anybody wants.
NAFB contributed to that report. And now here's AgNet West, Brian German, with more agriculture news.
Industry members are encouraged to be quick to respond to notices from the California Air Resources Board. Director of Regulatory and Environmental Affairs for Western United Dairies, Paul Souza, said he worked with a dairy that received a notice of audit for the low-use exemption of the truck and bus rule from ARB, which could have turned into a costly problem without quick action.
So it wasn't a problem. This truck really was a low-use truck, way under the 1,000 miles. So I worked with the dairy and submitted a picture of the odometer of that truck. ARB got back to us and said they wanted us to include the letter that ARB had sent, that notice of audit, in the picture to show that we weren't using an older photo to make the odometer reading work. So again, no problem. Took another picture with the letter in it, sent it to them. They said, we got your letter. Everything's fine. You're in compliance. A couple days later, I get kind of a frantic call from that dairy saying, we got this notice of violation and it's proposing a $10,000 fine for not responding to the notice of audit letter. You know, we did everything. We were in compliance. I contacted ARB and basically their response was, those two documents must have crossed the mail. We sent them an email of the photo and they were mailing out on the day of the deadline in the notice of audit letter. They didn't even wait for the deadline to really be done before they sent out the notice of violation with a proposed $10,000 fine. So my message is, if you get something in the mail from the Air Resources Board, if it's a notice of audit letter for your low use exemption truck, don't let that sit off to the side for too long. Definitely get on that and take care of that and respond to it.
The Global Produce and Floral Show is coming up next week in Anaheim. The International Fresh Produce Association will be offering educational sessions covering consumer, tech, and talent trends at the Global Produce and Floral Show, October 19th through the 21st at the Anaheim Convention Center. The first day of the conference will begin with a general state of the industry presentation, followed by discussions on fresh produce packaging, getting the job done with a changing workforce, generation-based marketing, and controlled environment agriculture. October 20th will cover topics including FSMA traceability, tracking and measuring sustainability, and regenerative agriculture. The final day of the conference will feature presentations on pathogen testing, equipment sanitation, and improving access to produce through innovation. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, cattle producers continue to keep their eyes on the proposed Opportunities for Fairness in Farming, or OFF Act. Senior Director of Government Affairs for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Tanner Beamer, explains what the bill would do and why they're against it.
So the Opportunities for Fairness in Farming Act is an interesting piece of legislation. That one is similarly perplexing in terms of what it would accomplish, because it essentially would say that checkoffs are not allowed to contract with entities that employ a registered federal lobbyist. That is a pretty obvious attack at the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, but other checkoffs as well, not just us. The problem with that logic is that what about some of the research that's done, right? The checkoffs do research and promotion. And from a research perspective, I'll just give you an example. The soybean checkoff contracts with the American Lung Association to do human health research on soy-based products. The American Lung Association employs a federal lobbyist because they are a trade association. That research would have to then, cease, basically. So it's a very narrow-minded view of this. And again, checkoffs are already prohibited by law from influencing public policy. The other thing that the OFF Act would do is it would prohibit checkoff funds from being used to disparage other commodities. That is already a rule that USDA very, very diligently enforces. So it's not really creating a whole lot of new ideas or introducing new ideas to this discussion. It's expanding upon some of the existing safeguards that are already in place and working well, and doing it in a very narrow-minded way that's actually going to end up having negative consequences for the very people that pay into those checkoffs.
Beamer says if ranchers decide they don't want a checkoff program, there is action they can take.
They need to sign a petition, and there is a formal process at USDA to do this, but they would begin collecting signatures on a petition, and they have to get at least 10% of cattle producers to sign that petition. And cattle producer is someone who owned cattle and paid an assessment into the checkoff, according to USDA's Census of Agriculture results. And USDA does check every one of those signatures to make sure that it is a bona fide cattle producer. So if in the event that they do get 10% submitted in the prescribed time frame, then there would be another producer referendum on whether to continue the checkoff or not. But thus far, there is a very vocal minority of disgruntled cattle producers who are not fans of the checkoff for whatever reason. But again, that is a vocal minority. The vast majority of cattle producers see the value that the beef checkoff provides back to them. And USDA estimates that, I think at this point, to be about $11.91 per dollar invested into the checkoff.
He says he has theories on why proposals like the OFF Act keep turning up.
I think that it is because, if you look at organizations like the Humane Society of the United States, like ASPCA, right? These are massive organizations with troves of money, and they aggressively fundraise throughout the course of a year. And the vast majority of those funds do not go to local pet shelters. They go straight into advocacy operations for these two organizations. And again, most of what they're trying to accomplish is an eradication of animal agriculture.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's Livestock Report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, during the World Dairy Expo held last week, the National Milk Producers Federation shared information about discussions being held concerning the Farm Bill. Will Jordan has more details.
Missing their September 30 deadline for passage of a Farm Bill, Congress still has work to do. A stopgap funding bill extended government funding for another 45 days, yet turmoil in the House of Representatives leaves concern among agricultural groups. 81.1% of the $1.5 trillion in funding for the Farm Bill goes towards funding SNAP programs, leaving a small margin for crop insurance and other programs to share. During a recent press conference at World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin, Greg Dowd, National Milk Producers Federation COO, shared that funding discussions essentially come down to regional fights over what's left over in the pie. Hear more from NMPF's Dowd on why the Farm Bill takes so much time to get right.
So we've had all of these meetings. What the staff has done is put pen to paper, and what they're really doing is going through and amending the law. So it's Microsoft Word, deleting and inserting, deleting and inserting. You've got the lawyers that have made the changes. It's taken longer than usual this time around because every time you make one of those changes, you have to submit the language then to the Congressional Budget Office. And then they give you back, well, that if you do that, it costs this much money to make this specific change in this specific sentence. And so you have to collect all that information from the CBO to give to your boss to calculate, okay, every time I turn a dial in terms of making one of these changes, how does the money come out in the end? And so all of this process has gone through to a point where we are just about ready to see, now this is jargon, but it is called the chairman's mark, which means Debbie Stabenow, Senator Stabenow, Chairwoman Stabenow, and then G.T. Thompson in the House will come out to the committee and say, here it is. This is the document for everybody to view, and then they will schedule a committee markup.
A unique aspect of this Farm Bill is that many of the Ag Committee members have less than a year of experience on the Ag Committee, and even fewer have experience with a Farm Bill markup. Dowd continued by saying,
well, you're not going to get it done this year. That's just not possible, particularly considering that you don't have a Speaker of the House. Here's a critical thing you need to know. We need to know who the next Speaker of the House of Representatives is. And the first question U.S. agriculture should ask the new Speaker is the Farm Bill, or will you please make the Farm Bill a big priority to get done? ASAP, please. And we have to know what the answer to that is.
For more information, visit agnetwest.com. For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
Thanks, Will. And Dairy Management Incorporated wants to remind you they are accepting applications from college students for the 2024 New Product Competition. The competition seeks innovative dairy product concepts and is open to undergraduate and graduate students in the U.S. DMI wants students to develop innovative dairy-based products for health and wellness consumers. Successful entries must meet competition criteria and demonstrate innovation and provide value to customers. Learn more at usdairy.com. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A new USDA pilot program has grant funding now available for ag employees needing resources to address various farm labor and workforce challenges. Rod Bain has more coming up in today's This Land of Ours report.
The ag sector in recent years has faced several challenges regarding its workforce.
How do ag employers support and create a safe and healthy work environment?
And according to USDA Farm Production and Conservation Deputy Undersecretary Gloria Montaño-Green, USDA's latest effort to address some of these issues is a new pilot program, the Farm Labor Stabilization and Protection Pilot. Up to $65 million in grants are available to domestic ag employers meeting federal employment criteria, with grant applications due November 20. More details are available online at www.ams.usda.gov/FLSP. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. The tax rules for deducting charitable contributions can be confusing. Cash donations are the simplest, but there still can be substantiation rules that might apply. The rules tripped up a taxpayer recently. Contributing to charity and claiming a tax deduction can be a good tax strategy for many, but the rules can be tricky, and they tripped up a taxpayer in a recent case. For starters, you can't deduct charitable contributions on your Schedule C sole proprietorship form. That's also true of an S corporation or partnership. Instead, your share is deductible on Schedule A, but only if you itemize. That means the charitable contribution won't reduce your self-employment tax. The tax court ruled for the IRS on that one. The tax court also sustained the IRS holding that only a portion of the taxpayer's non-cash charitable contributions were deductible. The value of donated clothing exceeded $5,000, and the taxpayer failed to get an appraisal as required when the fair market value of the clothing donated during the year exceeded that amount. The taxpayer argued that each individual contribution during the year was no more than $250, but it was the total of all contributions that counted. The deduction for charitable donations is an item that the IRS pays close attention to, especially when the claimed amount looks out of bounds based on the taxpayer's income. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
Well, here is a result of a musical experiment of mine, an experiment that went awry, I'm afraid. Take various versions of a song, sew them together like Dr. Frankenstein did with his monster.
I love the winter
weather,
so the two of us
can get together.
But really, I don't care who sings the song. I don't like the subject. I don't like winter. It never treats me well. It's early fall now, but I'm already dreading the winter that's rapidly approaching. A month or so into it, and I start to look pale and droopy, and my houseplants, same thing. They are dropping leaves like crazy by that time. Yeah, there goes another one. Big leaf there, huh? And Kansas State University horticultural expert Ward Upham says it's my fault, really, it turns out, or at least partly my fault. In the summer, my plants are outside. Then, right about now, I bring them in, put them back where they normally go in the house. Upham says I should have brought them in to the brightest area of the house and gradually, over a few weeks, move them to where they normally go. However, where they normally go in the house may not work for them. It's too dark.
The main stress is going to be light levels. It's not just the length of the day, but also the actual amount of light that is produced in the winter. Maybe 10% of the light you get in the middle of the summer is produced in the winter just because it's coming through more of the atmosphere.
Wow, 10%. And sometimes, even with the best of light, my plants look a little peaked, sort of like me.
And that's where people make a mistake.
Yes, I assume the problem can be solved by more fertilizer and more water. Wrong. Totally wrong. He says too much fertilizer and I can burn the roots, too much water and...
You can suffocate the roots.
Oh, that's great. Double murder.
Usually between November and February, if you fertilize at all, you never go over a quarter of the amount you normally use because that plant just isn't growing much. With water, you want to make sure you only water when that plant wants water.
And since I don't have talking plants, though, Ward, how would I know that?
Stick your finger into that soil at least an inch deep and see if it's moist. If it is, you don't water. Another way to tell whether it needs water is the weight of the pot. Now that you have to kind of get a feel for, but after a while you can tell if you lift it up whether it needs water or not.
Now in my house when we get really into the cold weather with the heat going, the air gets terribly dry, low humidity. How does that affect my plants?
It depends on which houseplant you have. Some really don't care. Others you may have to raise the humidity in a house with a humidifier. Some people will put the houseplants on a tray on pebbles with water in that tray, but not hitting the bottom of the pot. And that may raise the humidity right around the plant.
Oh, and quickly, a couple of more suggestions on where to put houseplants. One, Ward Upham says, if I have single-pane windows, Don't let those plants touch those. I should keep plants also away from doors to the outside and away from heat registers. So maybe if I do all of this, my plants this spring may not look like they need to go to the emergency room like usual. Now, if you only had some tips for keeping that from happening to me, Ward.
I love the winter weather.
Oh, stop it. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Geopolitical risk has taken center stage at the same time harvest reaches its peak. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Violence in the Middle East is being labeled the worst in 50 years. Jumps in crude oil prices now, consecutive days, supports grain futures as well. Strong energy prices and fears of global food security issues will remain until the duration of this violence is better known. Combines are rolling long hours today and tomorrow before rain is forecast to move in from west to east. Harvest progress and export news delayed from yesterday's federal holiday. We expect corn harvest tonight to show 35-38% complete, soybeans near 40%. Average dress cattle weights remain 2 to 3 pounds below the 5-year average for early October. Superior Livestock's latest video auction of nearly 30,000 head showed steers and heifers coming off grass $3 to $6 higher. Buyers were more cautious buying weaned calves at mostly steady to weaker money. That's our bottom line. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. My recipe today is going to be a berry cobbler. Yes, I said berry cobbler, the ultimate dish to eat as a dessert, especially when it's as hot as it's been outside. Nothing's better with a berry cobbler than some cold chantilly cream. Let's get started. The very first thing we're gonna do is using a food processor. And I'm going to add to my food processor 1 cup of flour. I'm also gonna add to my food processor 3/4 cup of sugar to this mixture. And I'm also gonna add to this another 1/4 cup of flour. I'm gonna add 2 pinches of salt. And I'm going to turn this on low, and then I'm going to turn this on high. I'm slowly going to incorporate into this mixture 2.5 ounces to start of vegetable shortening. Now, I know some people say cobbler's supposed to be with butter. I'm more of a shortening person. I like the flakiness of the crust, and so will you. So all I'm going to do is add in just a little bit at a time, 2.5 ounces of vegetable shortening. What we're looking for is this mixture to almost look like beach sand. Very brown in color and very coarse. This is very important because this means that it's going to be very, very flaky. If it doesn't look like this, then you're going to have to add just a little bit more. And you're really going to have to mix that around when it's in the food processor. Even if it means lifting up your food processor and shaking it while it's on. Trust me, these food processors were made to take a beating. Don't be afraid to really make this thing work. I'm going to pull that out and I'm going to pour that over the top of this mixture of fruit. Now, the best way to do this is to just get fresh fruit and pour a little bit of sugar over the top of the fresh fruit. Once it's over the top of the fresh fruit, then I'm going to put the cobbler mixture over it. I'm going to put my oven to 375 degrees, and I promise this is going to be absolutely fantastic. You're going to love the way this tastes. It takes about 45 minutes to an hour in the oven, uncovered, of course, because all we're trying to do is get our crust to get a nice browning on top of it. And that is where the remainder of all this comes out. Finishing off the recipe, we're just going to finish this with a simple Chantilly cream. So I use 1 cup of heavy cream, 1/2 cup of sugar, and I'm also going to add to this 1 tablespoon of vanilla bean paste. Or you can use 1 whole vanilla bean, or if you have just regular liquid vanilla, you can use that as well. But I promise this is something that you're definitely going to want to enjoy, appreciate, and love during summer and all the time. Always use seasonal fruit because that's the way it's going to taste best. I'm Albert J. Hernandez, and you all know me as the Unchained Chef from Agnet West.
The world ag productivity is not increasing fast enough. The Global Agricultural Productivity Report says the world agricultural productivity is consistently falling short of the target growth rate. Since 2011, productivity isn't growing fast enough to hit the target growth rate required to sustainably meet global needs for agricultural outputs by 2050. The report says total factor productivity growth continues to be strong in China and South Asia. However, sub-Saharan Africa and the U.S. show especially low TFP growth. From 2011 to 2021, global TFP grew at an average rate of 1.14% yearly. To sustainably meet the agricultural needs of a growing global population by 2050, the report says the world must now aim for 1.91% average annual TFP growth. If producers are able to access proven, appropriate productivity-enhancing tools, there can be significant improvements in closing the TFP growth gap. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
The end of September, the latest USDA quarterly stocks and small grains forecast. Chief Economist Seth Meyer looks at the findings within the latest reports, starting with supplies. With quarterly stocks for corn down 1% from this time last year, and soybeans down 2% year over year.
I don't think that there was a huge surprise in terms of where the stocks in aggregate turned out. I think that those were, relatively speaking, within the range of trade expectations, maybe a little bit more soybean stocks than folks had anticipated at the higher end of that range. And I think you are seeing the market respond to that. Maybe higher end of the range there on soybean stocks, putting a little downward pressure on soybeans.
All wheat stocks are up slightly from 1 year ago, the current number at 1.78 billion bushels. The chief economist also notes that perhaps most surprising from the quarterly stocks report,
when you compare it to, say, the previous year, the share of stocks held by farmers versus those held in commercial hands, the share held by farmers increased pretty substantially for both corn and soybeans. And while that's technically on-farm storage, so it doesn't really indicate who owns that. If a farmer's forward sold it, I don't think that's a big factor here. But what I will say is the farmers appear to be holding a larger share of the grain entering this new marketing year than they did in past years into a falling market price. And so the question will be is how will farmers market that grain going forward?
Meanwhile, the quarterly small grains report indicated winter wheat production up 13% from September 2022.
We had a decline in harvested area. It's been tough all year to determine how that crop was really going to turn out. And it seems that we harvested a little bit less, and the yields as a total and on the rest of it ended up rising.
As for market reaction by the winter wheat production forecast, not a surprise, according to Meyer.
I think on some of the other spring wheats is where the real surprise this month was.
As production jumped, fueled by both increased harvested acre and yield totals, other spring wheat production is up 5% year over year. Durham wheat production, however, was down 7% from last year. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we have the latest episode from the Vineyard Team's podcast. Today, talking about NASA satellites detecting grapevine diseases from space. Here's show host Craig McMillan.
With us today, is Katie Gold, Assistant Professor of Grape Pathology at Cornell Agritech Campus of the Cornell University. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Today, we're going to talk about some really cool technology. I've been interested in it for a long time, and I can't wait to get an update on what all is happening. There's some really exciting work being done on using remote sensing for the detection of plant diseases. Can you tell us a little bit about what that research is about and what's going on in that field?
Sure. What isn't going on in this field? It's a really exciting time to be here. So I guess to put into context, we're really at this precipice of an unprecedented era of agricultural monitoring. And this comes from the intersection of, you know, hardware becoming accessible, the data analytics becoming accessible, and also investment. You know, a lot of talk of ag tech being the next big thing. And with that comes this interest in using these cool and novel data streams for disease detection. So my group specializes in plant disease sensing. It's our bread and butter. It's what we entirely focus on. And we specialize in a technology called imaging spectroscopy for disease detection. So this is also known as hyperspectral imaging. Imaging spectroscopy is the technical term. And this is a type of remote sensing that it differs from, you know, radio wave remote sensing, and it focuses on light in the visible to shortwave infrared range.
Talk a little bit more about that. So when we talk about hyperspectral, we're looking outside of the range of radiation, essentially, that's not just light.
So yes and no. So hyperspectral is a word that describes how the light is being measured. Kind of colloquially, we assign to it more meaning than it actually has. That's why I often like to differentiate between it. For explanation's sake, what hyperspectral imaging is, when we talk about using it in the full V-sphere range, these are all types of light. You know, it's all aspects of the electromagnetic radiation scale. But this spectrum of light that ranges from the visible to the shortwave infrared, this spans a range of about 2100 wavelengths. So to put that into context, we see visible light only. And this spans a range of wavelengths that's about 300 nanometers in width, from about 450 to 750. So if you think about all the richness, the gradation, the subtlety and differences in color that you see in everyday light, all of that comes from those subtle interactions of, you know, specific wavelengths of light hitting that stuff and bouncing back into our eye. So now imagine having seven times more wavelengths than that. You know, we have 2100 different wavelengths that we measure. And those wavelengths that are beyond the range that we can see, the reason why we don't see them is they're less abundant, they're less emitted by our sun, but they're still present and they still interact with the world. In particular, they interact very strongly with chemistry, such as environmental chemistry. So imaging spectroscopy was developed by NASA to tell us what Mars was made out of. Then one day they're like, let's turn this baby around and point it at the Earth. And we discovered that it's quite applicable for vegetative spectroscopy. So telling us what vegetation is made of, what the composition of the Earth is. And because plant disease impacts chemistry so dramatically, plant physiology, chemistry, morphology, such a dramatic, chaotic impact, it's a really excellent technology to use for early detection. So those subtle little changes that occur within a plant before it becomes diseased to the human eye, but it's undergoing that process of disease.
Can you expand on that point? Exactly how does this work in terms of the changes in the plant that are being picked up by viewing certain wavelengths? What's the connection there?
Consider the leaf, right? So plants are an amazing thing to remotely sense because they're designed by nature to interact with light. Now that's in contrast to skin, right? That's designed to keep light out. Plants are designed to have light go in and out, etc. So light will enter our atmosphere from the sun, and it will do one of three things when it encounters a plant. It'll be reflected back, it will be absorbed for photosynthesis, or it will be transmitted through the plant. And the wealth of that light is actually reflected back, and that reflected light can be detected by something as distantly placed as a satellite in orbit. And how that light is reflecting off a plant is determined by the health status of a plant. So a healthy leaf, right? It's going to be photosynthesizing. This means that it's going to be absorbing red and blue light for photosynthesis. It's going to have a lot of chlorophyll. It's going to be nice, bright, and green. It's going to reflect back a lot of green light. And then it's going to reflect back near infrared light because that is the sort of light that corresponds really well to the cellular structure of a leaf, right? So a nice, healthy leaf, it's going to bounce back near infrared light. Now, an unhealthy plant, it's not going to be photosynthesizing properly, so it's going to be absorbing less red and blue light. Therefore, it will be reflecting more of that red light back. It's not going to have a lot of chlorophyll, so it's going to reflect back less green light. And it's not as healthy, it's not as robust, so it will reflect back less near infrared light. So by looking at those subtle differences, and this is where we get back to that idea of hyperspectral, right? Hyperspectral is a word about how a sensor is measuring light. And hyperspectral means that a sensor is measuring light at such narrow intervals that it's a near continuous data product. And this is in contrast to a multispectral sensor, something like NDVI, that measures light in big chunks.
Oh.
So the power is when you have continuous data, right? You could do more complex analyses. You just have more to work with than when you have discrete data. This is what makes hyperspectral sensors more powerful. It's how they're measuring the light, and often that they're measuring more light than our eyes can see. But that's not necessarily a given. Hyperspectral sensors do not need to measure beyond the visible range. They can solely be focused in the visible range because, once again, hyperspectral is a word about how the light is being measured. But we oftentimes kind of colloquially so assign more value to it. But let's take that in combination, right? So you have a hyperspectral sensor that's measuring light in very, very narrow intervals, near continuous data product. You're measuring 7 times more wavelengths than the eye can see. Combined together, that's how this works, right? So those subtle differences in those wave bands, how they're reflecting both direct interactions with plant chemistry, you know, some certain wavelengths of light will hit nitrogen bonds, go wackadoo and bounce back all crazy. Otherwise, we're making indirect inferences, right? You know, plant disease is a chaotic impact to plant health that impacts lots of areas of the spectrum. So we're not directly measuring the chemical impact, right? We're not saying, okay, well, nitrogen is down 2, sugars are up 3, starch XYZ. We're measuring that some indirect impact.
That's pretty amazing. And so
I think it's cool, right? Yeah.
So the idea here is that there are changes in the leaf that can be picked up in these other wavelengths that we wouldn't see until it's too late.
Exactly.
Okay. So it's a warning sign.
Yep.
That gives us a chance to change management.
Ideally so, right? So it depends on with the scale at which you're operating. So now here comes another level, right? So if you're considering just that one individual plant, it's different from when you're considering the whole scale of a vineyard, right? You want your sensing to be right-sized to the intervention that you're going to take. So my group works with 2 types of diseases primarily. We work with grapevine viral diseases as well as grapevine foliar diseases. For example, grapevine downy mildew, which is an oomycete pathogen, and grapevine powdery mildew, which is caused by a fungal pathogen. Now, the sort of intervention that you would take for those 2 diseases is very different, right? With a viral disease, the only treatment that you have is removal. There's no cure for being infected with the virus. Now, with a fungal pathogen or an oomycete pathogen like grapevine downy mildew, if you detect that early, there are fungicides you can use with kickback action, or otherwise you might change the sort of what sort of choice you might make a fungicide, right? If you know there's an actual risk in this location, you might put your most heavy-hitting fungicides there. Then in areas where there is no disease detected or risk is incredibly low, you might feel more comfortable relying on a biological, thereby reducing the impact. So given the sort of intervention you would take, we want to right size our sensing approach for it. So with grapevine viral diseases, when the intervention is so has such a vast financial impact, right, removal, we want to be incredibly sure of our data. So we focus on high spectral resolution data products for that. Ones where we have lots of wavelengths being measured with the most precise accuracy so that we can have high confidence in that result, right? We want to give that to someone and say, hey, we are very confident this is undergoing asymptomatic infection. Now, on the other hand, with these foliar diseases, they change at such a rapid timescale that you're more benefited by having an early warning that may be less accurate, right? So you're saying, hey, this area of your vineyard is undergoing rapid change. It might be due to the disease. It might be because your kid drove a golf cart through the vineyard. However, we're warning you regardless to send someone out there and take a look and make a decision as to what you might do. Ideally, we would have a high spectral resolution regardless, right? Because more spectrum or better, but the realities of the physics and the actual logistics of doing these sensing is that we don't get to do that. We have to do a trade-off with spectral, spatial, and temporal resolution. So if we want rapid return, high degrees of monitoring, and we want that at high spatial resolution suitable for a vineyard, we lose our spectral resolution. So we lose our confidence in that result, but our hope is that by saying, hey, this is a high area of change, and getting you that information very quickly, you can still make an intervention that will be yield successful response, right? You'll go out there and you'll be like, oh, yep, that's downy mildew. Otherwise, like, I'm going to take my kid's keys. Like, he's out here in my vineyard again.
Right.
So it's kind of, we're balancing, right? So we have the logistics of the real world to contend with in terms of using sensing to inform management intervention.
Again, this was just a portion of the episode. To listen to the full podcast, visit vineyardteam.org. Stay tuned. We'll have more Ag News after the break.
October 12th is National Farmers Day, a time dedicated to those who wake before the sun rises and often work until long after it sets. Thanks to farmers' tireless efforts, we have the food, feed, fiber, and fuel we need here in America and plenty more for export. Best of all, farmers produce all of this sustainably, so that future generations can have the same bounty. Today and every day, please join Syngenta in honoring the men and women of American agriculture.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Coordination of the specialty crop industry is one of the keys to remaining competitive. President and CEO of California Citrus Mutual, Casey Kramer, said the unified effort of the specialty crop industry is making headway with having important market conversations with lawmakers.
The competitiveness conversation, even on the Farm Bill and how that's rolled out, whenever it is rolled out, but the Specialty Crop Farm Bill Alliance is really focused on competitiveness as a key factor. And so I think whether it's in the Farm Bill or whether it's on the ATAC or any other interactions with Congress and the administration, it's a focus on competitiveness and doing everything we can to ensure that U.S. domestic producers can remain competitive in a global marketplace. And so a lot of other countries, you know, implement multiple policies that protect their domestic industry. And it's just time that, you know, there's that focus here in the United States as well. And I sense that it's shifting. When we go back to D.C., you start to hear a little bit more of that competitiveness and protecting the domestic industries and workforce as well. And so that's kind of the direction I think that it's going, and why it's important to play a part with any government proceeding that you possibly can to help steer that direction. It doesn't mean that you get everything that you want. It just means that you have a seat at the table and to help steer it in a better direction than what it would have been if you hadn't been there.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
With just 4 months until the 2024 World Ag Expo kicks off in February, the show has announced its annual chairman. Stan Creelman is a local farmer to Tulare. He came in 1976 to help manage a custom harvesting operation, and since then he's held numerous roles in the agriculture industry, including managing the Mid-Valley cotton growers from 1989 to 2021. He served on the board of the National Cotton Council as president of the California Grower-Owned Gin and the California Cotton Ginners and Growers Association. He's also on the National Cotton Growers Association. The announcement was made at the annual kickoff dinner held last month. The 2024 show theme is The Best Farm Show on Dirt. And Creelman says he's honored to serve as the 2024 World Ag Expo chairman, saying, quote, "There's been so many great leaders before me, it's humbling to be among them." This will be the show's 57th year, and it's the largest annual outdoor ag trade show in the world. It features more than 1,200 exhibitors on 2.6 million square feet of exhibit space. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can visit worldagexpo.com.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.